Hi, this is Leonard Lopate. You're listening to WNYC On Demand. Podcasts, streaming, and MP3 downloads available when you want to listen at WNYC.org and iTunes.
WNYC On Demand is supported by DataPipe, delivering custom solutions for businesses with complex internet-facing infrastructures. DataPipe manages the entire infrastructure, including data center operations, servers, applications, storage, monitoring, and security. DataPipe.com.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Greed is out. Empathy is in. Empathy is the grand theme of our time. At least that's what biologist Franz de Waal claims in his new book, The Age of Empathy, Nature's Lessons for a Kinder Society. Dr. de Waal, who studies chimpanzees at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center in Atlanta, used his observations of those animals to explain how what he saw is changing the scientific community's understanding of human nature. And he concludes that a human's natural tendency is towards compassion. The book is published by Harmony Books, and I'm very pleased it has brought Dr. Franz de Waal back to our show. Hello.
Hi.
As I said, your main assertion is that empathy is the grand theme of our time. But I'm sure listeners are immediately thinking about all sorts of things that have been happening recently. On TV, we've been seeing bitter fighting over health insurance at town hall meetings, the arrests of suspected terrorists who want to blow us up, Tea Party gatherings, angry protesters at the UN and at the G20 summit. We're involved in a number of wars. There was a genocide in Rwanda, and people are being killed in lots of other countries. Are these all exceptions to the rule?
Well, killing will go on, and greed will never disappear, and capitalism will never die, I think. So I'm completely in agreement with that. But some of the upheavals that you describe are actually exactly because the American society is a bit fed up with the mentality at Wall Street and the excessive emphasis on competition. So some of these upheavals that occur actually are because the society, I think, is changing.
But on the other hand, in the healthcare debate, people who have good insurance coverage say they don't want to pay more to help others. That sounds to me more like Ayn Rand than Carl Rogers or Heinz Kohut.
Those people exist, and they're very prominent in this society, and they're very important. But I do think there's a little difference in emphasis coming at the moment. So, for example, when Wall Street collapsed, or at least almost collapsed, there was a lot of talk about an increase in fairness. And actually, the debate about bonuses is a debate about fairness. And the healthcare debate is an interesting debate because there's an entire group, including the president himself, who emphasize the common good and solidarity, and that we need to worry about others and we need to worry about those who have no insurance.
Well, I wonder if there are natural or national tendencies towards empathy. Do Americans who've always valued self-reliance have less tolerance for empathy than people in Europe, where there are more homogeneous societies?
I think that's true. You will not find a European politician who can get away with saying that we're all in it for ourselves. They all emphasize universal health care, and they all have universal health care.
And American politicians sure brought up empathy in the debate over the appointment of Sonia Sotomayor to the Supreme Court. And empathy was a negative in that debate.
According to some. So Obama said, I want a judge with empathy. And I think many people would agree that that's a good thing for a judge to have. And then there was a counter movement of people who said, why empathy? Who needs empathy? So those people exist. Yeah, there are two categories in this country, clearly.
Are humans more likely to be empathetic with those they already know and have close relationships with?
I think so. The empathy is almost always biased. And there's actually studies on mice even now. You wouldn't believe it, but there's mice studies on empathy where they have found that mice who have seen another fellow mouse in pain have a greater sensitivity to pain. And this only works between mice who know each other. So mice who don't know each other, it has no effect.
Now, you've been studying primates, but mice are much lower down the evolutionary scale. They still are mammals. How far down the evolutionary scale Can we go and still find something that would resemble empathy?
I think empathy is a multi-layered capacity, and the basic forms are that you are synchronized and imitate others and are emotionally affected by others. And that capacity is probably present, that very basic one is probably present in all the mammals. Well, I would not exclude the birds, but I think certainly in all the mammals.
Empathy literally translates as in feeling, and most people say it's the ability to put oneself into another's shoes.
No,
Is that how you would say it?
No, the emotion needs to be part of it. So, for example, psychopaths like Madoff or people like Kenny Lay, that kind of people, they have a capacity to put themselves in the shoes of others. And that's actually why they're so good at exploiting others. So that's a cognitive capacity, but it needs to go together with feelings for others. And if you don't have those, we call that a psychopath.
So it's not enough to just understand how other people feel.
Yeah.
It also has to, you have to feel for them.
Yeah, so you have to be synchronized somehow in your mind with their feelings and their situation.
You're right that until recently, empathy wasn't taken seriously by science. Even with regards to our own species, it was considered an absurd, laughable topic. Why is that? Because of social Darwinism?
I'm not sure that was related to that, but that's a story that I heard actually from a scientist, a female scientist who started the study of empathy in children 25 years ago. Her name is Zahn Wachsler, Carolyn Zahn Wachsler. She said she would be laughed out of the room if she started about empathy. For them, it was the same as telepathy and astrology. It was something ridiculous that only women could be interested in, potentially.
And how early in development did she find empathy beginning?
Year one already. So she did these experiments where she would instruct family members to start crying and sobbing and then see how the children reacted. And already at age one, they approach and touch the people. And what she found in that same experiment, and she did not intend to find that, is that the dogs in the home did the same thing. And so she told me that already at that time, she said, well, if we call it empathy in children, which she did, why not in dogs? You know?
What about, you talked about negative things, crying, mm-hmm. and we usually associate empathy with sad things. But what about when we suddenly get into contagious laughing? Or what happens when somebody yawns and then mm-hmm. everybody else in the room yawns?
Yeah, contagion, actually, synchrony and contagion are the basis of empathy very often. So if you talk with someone who frowns, you start frowning. You talk with someone who smiles, you start smiling. Yawn contagion is, those are all related to empathy. And yawn contagion is something we study in the chimpanzees. So we have these animated yawns. We have an animation that shows a yawning chimpanzee. And if you show that to chimps, they start yawning just like we would.
So you suggest all animals have an inner ape and that empathy comes naturally to our species.
Yeah, empathy is part of our survival skills because we are group animals, and so you need to worry about your group and you need to worry about other group members because you depend on them.
And I wonder whether in the savannah, whether there were already sociopaths, the Bernie Madoff types, saying, oh, gee, I found some food and I'm not going to share it with anybody.
Yeah.
I'll cheat you out of your food.
I'm pretty sure you have variation in everything. I think empathy is one of those very interesting characteristics where you have people who are high on it and people who are very low on it.
What over history, we've seen people appeal to the empathetic aspect of our nature.
The funny thing is that in American history, Lincoln talked about fellow feeling and sympathy, and Adam Smith, the great economist, who actually gave us this idea of market forces and so on, he talked already about sympathy being an important ingredient and it needed to be part of economy, otherwise you would get the sort of thing that actually happened a year ago. That's what he was foreseeing.
My guest is Franz De Waal, who is a biologist who works at the he is actually the C.H. Candler Professor of Psychology and Director of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center at Emory University. And his latest book is The Age of Empathy, Nature's Lessons for a Kinder Society. It's published by Harmony Books. The last time you were here, I think it was to talk about how bonobos make love, not war.
Although
it seems they do make war as well, but not as much as others. Is this all related?
The bonobo is a very interesting case because the bonobo is, let's say, a gentle ape. So we have two relatives. One is not so gentle, the chimpanzee, which is dominance-oriented and quite competitive. and the bonobo, which is more like a hippie-type primate. So I sometimes contrast them, but we share characteristics with both, and the characteristic I'm interested in at the moment, which is cooperation and empathy, is present in both of them.
And it's interesting that many animals survive by both cooperating and also attacking each other. Wolves.
Yeah. So sometimes people use the argument, they will say, how can chimpanzees have empathy? Because they occasionally kill each other. And they also kill monkeys and eat the monkeys. Now, if that was a criterion, then of course humans would also not have empathy, because humans do also both. And I think that's always very interesting to look at that tension between the two. We are clearly selfish, we're clearly competitive, and that's what we exploit in our capitalist system. But we are also highly cooperative, and we like solidarity and so on.
So when people make bald statements like Winston Churchill did when he said the story of the human race is war, you object?
I do object.
Even though war has been throughout the history of humans?
I do object, because the evidence for warfare in the human species goes back 15,000 years and not much further than that. And so it is very well possible, since we were hunter-gatherers at the time, that there was not much warfare. For example, the present hunter-gatherers, we know they have 90% of the time peace and 10% of the time maybe war. And Winston Churchill was sort of suggesting that it was the opposite. It's like peace was precarious and was very rare, and war was an unending thing that we always did.
So we do see it once in a while in the Amazon or New Guinea. In fact, there are some tribes that have actually worked out ritual warfare to mm-hmm. eliminate the real killing.
Yeah. And actually, there's an interesting book on human killing written by someone from the American Army, David Grossman, that humans have strong inhibitions to kill. And that's, for example, why very few soldiers during World War II actually did killing. And those who do in a war, they come back with post-traumatic stress disorder. So killing is not something that we naturally like to do.
So why did we go through that whole period after World War II where humans were routinely depicted as killer apes?
I think we were dealing with what happened during World War II, and Conrad Lawrence in Europe and Robert Ardrey here, they proposed that we have a killer instinct, that we are natural killers, and we like to hear that after World War II, I think, to justify what happened to some degree.
So we have in our DNA both aggressive mm-hmm. and pacifist tendencies.
We have both tendencies. We are highly competitive, but we are group animals. We are not solitary animals, and so all this emphasis on individualism and to build a society around what's good for me and I don't care about the rest is not really our primate nature, in my opinion.
But you've also said that humans are the most aggressive primates.
Yes.
I
think we are, and we are, partly are the most aggressive primates because we have such good weaponry, and so we're very effective killers.
Now, when we say that, are we talking about all humans, or are we talking about male humans?
More about males and females, obviously. Yeah, and so there's also an interesting empathy difference, is that people have now done experiments where you put humans in a brain scanner and you look at their brain when they see someone else in pain, for example. Both men and women, when they see someone else in pain, it activates their own pain centers as if they have themselves pain. So that's an empathic response. But now if you present them with someone who has cheated them in a game and you produce pain on them, The women still feel empathy for that person, but the man, now the pleasure centers in their brain light up, meaning that they actually take pleasure in seeing the pain of somebody else in this situation.
How did that work out in those studies that now scientists really are horrified by, but the ones in which people were encouraged to increase the voltage of electricity?
Oh, that's an old study. That's the Milgram study mm-hmm. where you could give 2,000 volts of pain to somebody.
Because that would also be an empathy study, wouldn't it?
Well, it was very interesting because as soon as the experimenter stepped out of the room, and this has been tested also in those days, as soon as the experimenter stepped out of the room and then came back, let's say 10 minutes later, saying that he had a phone call, the people would still produce shocks for the victims, but they would lower the voltage. Not telling the experimenter that they had done so, but they would immediately lower the voltage. So they were not happy to do this experiment, but they sort of cheated on it.
A listener wrote on our show page, how do you explain the female-dominated bonobo chimpanzee societies have much less territory than the regular male-dominated chimpanzees?
So why the females don't are not interested in territory? Is that the question, maybe? I think what happens in bonobos is there's matings between groups going on. So when groups meet, instead of having war, they have sexual encounters, which means that in the neighbor group, there's going to be a lot of relatives of them. So they have genetic relatives in the neighboring groups, and I think this has a reducing effect on territoriality.
Although we can't always say that there's empathy during sexual activity.
No, no, I'm not saying that they are empathic. I'm saying they're resolving their issues that way.
My guest is Frans de Waal, whose latest book is The Age of Empathy, Nature's Lessons for a Kinder Society. It's published by Harmony Books. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Frans de Waal, D-E-W-A-A-L, his latest book, The Age of Empathy, Nature's Lessons for a Kinder Society, published by Harmony Books. Your first book on primate behavior was Chimpanzee Politics, wasn't it, 1982. Were you already noticing signs of empathy?
Oh, yeah. In that time, I studied power struggles, and so I was very interested in competition between males. And we speak of we speak of politics because they have coalitions in order to achieve power. But at the same time, I saw already that they made up after fights. Victims of aggression were reassured by others, which we call consolation behavior. It was very typical. And I actually decided to study these more positive tendencies, such as empathy and cooperation, because we had a killing in the colony. Two males killed their rival, basically. It was a political killing. It was over power. And I was very upset by it. And I saw that these mechanisms that they had to make up after fights, that they were very important, and that if they failed, everything collapsed.
Now, you were seeing animals in captivity. Would it be different in the wild? Because her book about chimpanzees, although that work that was done on chimpanzees, now I'm suddenly forgetting her name. Isn't that
Jane
term?
Goodall, probably.
Yeah. She talked about the way males challenge each other for the top job, and it really had more to do with just presenting themselves as being more powerful, but not really fighting.
This was at the time that she started working. That was the idea. But killings have now also been seen killings have been seen in chimpanzees in the field, both between groups, which is territorial, and so that's an in-group out-group thing. But now there's also reports very similar to the one that I had in Arnhem. So when I first reported the one for the Arnhem Zoo, people would say, "Oh, that happens only in captivity." But we have now multiple cases in the field.
But also, you report that. Is it the Thai National Park in Ivory Coast? Chimpanzees were seen to care for others that have been wounded by leopards.
Yeah, so this is very costly altruism, that sort of jargon that we use for this, is that it's altruistic behavior that has extreme cost. What chimpanzees do in Thai forest is that if one of them is attacked by a leopard, there's a special scream that they give, and all the others will then come over, run over from the forest and chase the leopard off. So that's very costly, and they will take care of the wounded individuals. They slow down their travel for them. And so this kind of solidarity, you could call it, or empathy, is present in chimpanzees in the field as well.
And you said that we see it throughout the mammal world. In this past July, you wrote a column for the Huffington Post that was called "Whale Shows Empathy." Two examples of animals showing empathy towards humans.
Yeah.
So they not only show empathy toward their own species, but they can show empathy towards others. We've heard all about dolphins doing that sort of thing.
Yeah, once you have the capacity for empathy, you can apply it beyond your own species, as we also do, humans, of course. We take care of whales who have stranded and things like that. And so empathy is actually a capacity that can range beyond your immediate clique, you know.
And we often hear reports of pets who will spot when somebody is not feeling well and suddenly become, curl up in the bed next to them or try to give them solace in some way or other.
Yeah, the reason we have mammal carnivores as pets, which is cats and dogs, basically, which is a bit of a curious decision that we have taken. But the reason we have them, I think, is because they're mammals and they are in tune with our emotions and we can be in tune with their emotions. Very few people have iguanas or turtles or snakes where you don't have that kind of contact with them.
Because they don't have any empathy at all?
No, I think reptiles have very little or nothing of that. And so I do think birds have it, but for birds we have very little data. But for mammals we have tons of data now that there is a certain capacity to be emotionally affected by others.
Maybe that's why we call an unempathetic behavior cold-blooded.
Yeah, and so there's a book, for example, on people like Madoff and Kenny Lay and so on. It's called Snakes in Suits. It's a book on psychopaths in business, and I always find that a very appropriate term because it's a reptilian term.
My guest is Franz de Waal. His latest book, The Age of Empathy, Nature's Lessons for a Kinder Society, is published by Harmony Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. We have a number of messages from listeners. One asks if empathy is more a right brain or more of a left brain activity. Do you know?
I don't think we know. We know that there is increasing neuroscience on empathy. And, for example, mirror neurons are involved. I don't know if you've heard of those,
sure.
But they're affected by the actions of others in the same way as your own actions. But there's a left brain, right brain thing. We don't know that.
And mirror neuron systems have now been linked to autism.
Yeah,
because autistic people have problems being empathetic.
Yeah, and so, for example, this very basic form of empathy, we talked about yawn contagion or laugh contagion, that's absent in autistic children. And so we don't know if that's a deficit in empathy, which is one thing, or it's a deficit in attention, that they don't pay attention to the expressions of others. We don't know yet.
A listener comments on our show page about two cats he once had. One cat died. This cat liked fuzzy magnetic figures. When it died, they placed all the fuzzy figures in a drawer. The other cat, one day, weeks later, sat in front of the refrigerator on a hunch. I took out one of the figures and placed it on the door. He swiped at it. He had never shown any interest in doing that previously.
Hmm. How interesting.
I wonder if that's empathy.
I'm not sure that that's what it is, but yes, there are many animals who are, for example, very attached to the one who they live with and who actually sometimes die when one of them dies. And so, for example, especially in birds who are pair bonded, if the partner dies, then the other one dies a little later.
I mentioned earlier Ayn Rand, mm-hmm. who said that there really isn't empathy. Everything is done in self-interest. And a lot of people subscribe to that. Does empathy still fit in with that philosophy?
For me, that's the most curious view, because she basically celebrates selfishness. Selfishness is good.
Well, she says we do show empathy for people we love, and mm-hmm. That's because it's in our self-interest.
Yeah, but empathy, once it exists, and it exists clearly in our species, it can reach far beyond the ones that you just love and the ones that you live with. And so Ayn Rand, I never understand, because he's completely focused on selfishness as a virtue. And I've always learned that it was a vice. So I totally don't understand this.
How do you interpret behaviorism in the research done by the father of behaviorism, John Watson?
Well, John Watson was one who hated emotions. He actually felt that maternal instinct and maternal emotions for children were interfering with childcare, and so he wanted to raise children in a scientific way, as he called it, just with reward and punishment. And for example, the Bulgarian or the Romanian orphanages were inspired by Watson's ideas and behaviorism. I think behaviorism is a very dangerous way of looking at the psychology of humans, because it sort of tries to exclude the emotions, and the emotions are so clearly present in everything we do.
He had a theory of the overkissed child.
Yeah, you shouldn't
show too much love for your child.
You shouldn't hug your child, you shouldn't kiss it too much. And if you ever do things like that, like hugging, you should only do it after they've done something wonderful to reward them. And that's the only reason why you would ever do that.
Hmm. And what's happening otherwise? And you're spoiling them, or you're making them needy?
Or they may
even hug a spouse. So, I mean,
he had all sorts of opinions about these things, and both him and B.F. Skinner, they tried to improve the human race, and Skinner wrote about how you could create a much better society if you, for example, did not give preference to your family members and didn't bias your thinking towards family members. I don't understand that kind of thinking. It's totally abiological, in my opinion.
You have suggested that we need a complete overhaul of our assumptions of human nature.
Yeah, what I'm in this book partly objecting to is the idea that competition-based society is in accordance with nature and is in accordance with Darwinism. It's called social Darwinism. And so if you look at nature, that's not how things work. Like, competition is important, obviously, but cooperation is equally important for many species. And so I feel that those who look at nature as an example for society and say it all needs to be struggle and struggle for survival, they have a very narrow view of what nature is about.
Yesterday I spoke to Rebecca Solnit, who's written a book about how people come together and help each other after a disaster like 9/11, like Katrina, like an earthquake, tsunami. It doesn't always last, but for a time there is this change and a real sense of community. Do you think we're going to be going through that now because of the financial crisis of 2008, or are we already seeing a hardening of positions?
No, I think after the crisis of 2008, we realized that a completely competition-based system leads to greed and gambling, and that we need to sort of regulate that. And so that an unregulated system is not really acceptable. Katrina, for me, is awfully interesting because I'm a Dutchman, of course, and to see the flimsy levees that they had built there, and then they collapse, and now what they rebuilt is just as flimsy, in my opinion, gives me the impression that what the U.S. needs is a bigger emphasis on the common good, in the sense that you cannot have a city like New Orleans drown just because you don't take care of it. That's not an acceptable position, in my opinion.
A listener wonders about empathy and scientific inquiry. For example, must empathy be suspended for practical purposes, like being mean to mice as you study their capacity for empathy?
Well, the mouse study was done in a pain laboratory where they test pain on mice, and that's how they found that mice sensitivity to pain increases when they see other mice in pain. And yes, some scientists probably need to turn off their empathy. Some doctors in emergency rooms, they need to turn down their empathy, otherwise they cannot do their work. And so, yes, we regulate it regarding the circumstances.
Because some of us, when we see somebody bleeding or in real pain, really cannot function. You have to be able to actually disassociate yourself from the experience, which means suspending your empathy.
Yeah, so we have a capacity to regulate our empathy, so empathy does not automatically lead to you being heavily involved in the life of somebody else.
So where are we going with all of this? Do you think you suggest that we're entering into an age of empathy? I'm just, as I said at the beginning, reading the newspaper, I'm not seeing it.
Well, I'm not arguing that we would, when we enter the age of empathy, so to speak, that we suspend everything else. So I think we are a species that has a capacity for intense competition, but also a capacity for intense cooperation. And I think we are probably entering an era in which we do a little bit less of the first and a little bit more of the second. I'm not saying that the one will take over the second. That's not going to happen.
Well, I am made hopeful by one of the studies you report at the Arnhem Zoo. An adult male chimpanzee saved a duckling from aggressive juvenile chimps from his own group.
Yeah, so that kind of incidents I report in this book, a lot of anecdotal evidence, but there's also now systematic studies where people do experiments. And we did an experiment where, for example, monkeys could choose between two options. One gave them themselves food, and the other one gave themselves plus their partner food, and they preferred the option where the partner also got food. And so there's a lot of these studies now that indicate pro-social tendencies in the primates.
Franz de Waal, his latest book is called The Age of Empathy, Nature's Lessons for a Kinder Society. It's published by Harmony Books. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening to WNYC On Demand. Please check out the other programs at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This is a free service made available by our listeners. Become a member of WNYC today.